consciousness is that which is not matter or energy. Now, that sounds a bit silly, but it probably is the best definition you can have. Consciousness, therefore, is life. And life carries with it, as I said yesterday, necessity for having a form. Life is, therefore, belonging to the divine life in whatever form it's found, and is of the nature of that unity which is the divine life. Now, the form in which it manifests, or through which it works, depends upon a pattern or a fixation of the divine life, which is created, generally speaking, in mind matter, in mind stuff, because it's a peculiar nature of mind at the divine level and at the world level, which would be the higher mental level, and at the etheric level, because the etheric is allied or attached or corresponds to the mental world in the ability that it has to hold a pattern. Now, when you get a vehicle through which consciousness works, you get a pattern at one of those levels which holds it in place. And that pattern has been likened to the difference between an ordinary egg and a fertilized egg. Now, scientists have shown that a fertilized egg has around it an etheric field of force which can be measured magnetically. Now, when that field of force is there, the egg is fertilized and can, given the right conditions of heat and temperature and all the rest of it, hatch into a chicken. But when the field of force is not there, then it can never hatch. You see, the egg is the instrument, the body, but it has to have that ensouling pattern of a field of force which belongs to the form aspect of the logos or the divine force before life can play through it. Now, yesterday we talked about the monad. We got as far as the definition of the ego. Remember that the monad was a spark of the divine, a spark in the flame, undetached is the word used in the secret doctrine. And on individualization, the Atma Buddhi Manas is vivified and the causal body is born. Then there are five original cosmic atoms, which are called permanent atoms, and they are attached as anchors for the descent into the modern, into the lower worlds. Now, when the monad comes down, it skips the higher planes, the causal level on the way down, and starts its work at the mental, and then comes down with the elemental essence to the mineral, because evolution starts at the bottom. In fact, that's an occult law that we can only develop by starting at the bottom. As we evolve as human beings, we have to start at the very basis before we can work up. We have to purify and work out the correlations within the physical body and the astral body and the mental body before the spiritual force can come down. So you see, it's no good saying that you can become developed spiritually until you have completely mastered the lower bodies. And that the same principle applies in the evolution of life as a monad. It starts in the mineral. But there it is completely latent, because the monad cannot of its own powers do anything at all below its own level, which is the sixth subplane, Anapadika. It can't do anything below that. It has to create another vehicle, which is the ego. But that vehicle comes down straight to the lower mental world and is then in a sleeping or latent condition and begins, as I said yesterday, to just to thrill a little bit to sensation in the mineral world, and wakes in the vegetable and begins to become conscious in the animal. And then there is that complete vivification at the human level. Now, it's important to remember that each descent is a limitation, what Mr. Janarajadasa calls a veil over consciousness. It is the limitation of the spirit by dense form and matter. So we have that principle working all the time. As soon as the monad goes to the next plane, which is the atmic, it is limited. In fact, it doesn't go down. It has to create an instrument at that level, atma, buddhi, manas, which is the causal body. As soon as the causal body, the consciousness descends from the atmic to the buddhic level, the atmic has a veil drawn over it and is therefore limited. Now, when the consciousness goes further down to the higher mental, I'm talking about the egoic consciousness now, a veil is drawn over its action on the mental plane, on the buddhic plane. You see? So each time it's limited. So we have to remember that principle. Keep that in mind when we're thinking about the effect of consciousness. The life, which is consciousness, is pure and complete at its own level, at the divine level. It's more pure and complete at the egoic level, but as it goes lower into the world of the personality, thoughts and feelings and physical and factors, as soon as it leaves its own higher, pure level, it is by stages limited, confined, and veiled. Now, as far as consciousness goes, in the human being, in man, once it is vivified, it becomes what has been called the imperishable body of light. Shining Orgoides is a term that's used in the secret doctrine, Mr. Hodson uses, but Mr. Gardner uses the term an imperishable body of light, which is a very good term, because it's imperishable in the sense it retains with us light until we complete our evolution. We don't complete our evolution until we slip back. Not just slipping back into Buddhic consciousness, which is, or even to Atmic, which is Nirvana, but slipping right back to the Logos. And then the monads, of course, the threads are pulled in and the sparks go back to the whole. But that's at the end of a Manvantara, and that's a long way ahead. We can't think of that in time and space. So within those limits, it's an imperishable body. And it has a life of its own. In other words, it's much bigger than any one of us. That's why I like this diagram. It's especially meant to show that. That is the ego, or the higher self, the imperishable body of light, extending up to the atmic plane and down to the middle of the mental plane, the fourth subdivision, the fourth subplane of the mental plane. And it's got a life in it of its own, complete, and quite apart from us. Now, when it descends as egoic consciousness into the personality, down to the mental and the astral, it does so in limitation. And what actually happens, and what is consciousness as we know it, is just the play of that higher self into the personality, which is the astro-mental body. You remember how those bodies were built. When a person is going to incarnate, the first thing that happens is that you get, I'll do this from memory because I've got some notes on somewhere, I'll try and do it from memory. You get, first of all, the right conditions. Now, the light conditions karmically, and we'll have something to say about that later, perhaps. That is, and astrologically, it's the right time. The right time, not astrologically, the right time karmically, and then, of course, you have to consider the right place, the right nation in which you are to be born, and the right parents. Now, when those things are there, and the permanent atom you can't say in the right position, but anyway, is ready to be vivified, well, it does become ready to be vivified, it has to. But it starts at the mental level, and that probably is years before actual birth. I don't know how far. I once asked Mr. Hodson, and he said he thought it was some years, but nobody's very definite about that. But anyway, it starts at the mental level. So the mental permanent atom is vivified and collects around it matter of the mental world, which corresponds to its own inner nature, its own particular note. So it brings around it, collects around it, and forms into its mental body matter that corresponds or is in tune with its own individual note. Going back again, remember, to the note of the monad. Through the ego, the same note is sounded, and that is what collects matter of a similar nature and gives us a mental body that fits in with our past and present. Because in the permanent atom of the mental body is contained not only all our past, but also the future perfection that we are to be. So you see, you've got that pattern on which to build. Now then, when the embryonic mental body is fairly complete, then the atom of the astral body is set vibrating, and it collects it round it, matter of the astral plane, and builds an astral body that again has your particular note. Well then, after that has been done and complete, then you, at conception, you get the physical permanent atom there, and then around that is built the etheric counterpart of the physical body, and around the etheric counterpart is built the physical body itself. So it's been said the auric envelope is pure at birth. Now, that means it's pure in that it contains only your own pattern, the pattern that is yours because you've acted in the past in certain ways and inherited it by your own... it's yours because it belongs to your permanent atom. Now, when anything comes in outside that, it makes or creates impurity in the self. Now, that happens probably in the prenatal period, because there the astral body impinges on the astral body of the mother and possibly of other people, you see? And there you are getting something extraneous coming in and making the, modifying the purity that was there at birth. It's not that it's incomplete at birth. It is complete. It's complete in the sense that it contains all the past of the individual. But it's pure in the sense it contains only that past and not the outside world. Of course, as soon as a child is born, then, and even in the prenatal period, environment and the thoughts and feelings of other people and the whole of the state of the world and world thought affects the individual, social conditions and everything else. So when you come to the question of free will and predetermination, you've got a definite answer if you look at it that way. There is absolute free will, and there is absolute predetermination. The ego chooses within the limitations of its own karma, because karma doesn't exist in the world of the ego, it only goes up to the world, top of the world of the personality, the fourth subplane of the mental world. But within the limitations of that karma, which is sometimes called starting karma, which is allocated for one particular life, within the limitations of that, the ego is free. But it isn't free because it voluntarily conditions itself for that particular life. In other words, it accepts for its own good the limitations that are going to be put upon it by birth into a particular parentage or surroundings. That really is quite clear. The limitation is voluntarily accepted by the ego. Now, then, within those limitations which are voluntarily accepted at the beginning, there is free will. We can at any time overcome the limitations into which we are born by calling down more force, getting more in tune with the higher self or the egoic life. We can immediately overcome those limitations at any time. We can modify them. Principle of karma is, of course, that it gives us limitations, but they are always able to be modified by our effort. And that applies also to astrology. Astrology is one of the methods by which the limitations are placed upon the individual at birth. They're born under such and such a sign, and that is a limitation, but it's only a tendency. It can be overcome by any method, and by a lot of methods, the best of which, of course, is effort and the exertion of will. Is there anything I'd like to say about that? Some of you may be interested in astrology, but that's my personal point of view.
I should like to ask whether it's possible for an ego wanting to incarnate to draw together two people who would be suitable parents.
The question is whether an ego could draw together two people that would be suitable parents. Yes, I think so. And I think that a lot of the marriages that seem peculiar to or unlikely people getting married have that reason. They have, of course, the individual karma of the two people who get married, which brings them together, although in this particular incarnation they're not compatible. But at the egoic level they might be compatible. But I'm absolutely certain that if it's right that those two people are to be the parents for a particular child, and the child has earned the right karmically to have those two people as a parent, nothing can keep them from having that child. I'm certain that that is the case.
One wonders whether adoption would work somewhat along those lines too. The child perhaps couldn't get the parents it wanted because those parents weren't able to have a family.
Yes.
And then
they're brought together by adoption. Yes. Of course, if we start accepting those sort of things too much, we say, you can fool yourself. You can say, well, now, karmically, I'm to have that child, and I'm right in adopting it. But we don't know, you see. We only see the bottom. We don't see the top. But at the top, the whole thing would be clear. And there's only one course of action in that case. In all our lives, when we come up to a critical point like that, there probably is only one course of action. We say we make mistakes. Well, because that's the whole key to karma. Karma is, from the important point of view, is for us in this world of limitation, a repetition of mistakes. We have, life after life, met corresponding situations and reacted to them in such a way as to make a mistake. And we go on doing that life after life, and that is the thing that I think brings about a certain feeling of depression. We know we've done, and we've been silly, we've made a mistake, and we feel that we've done it in many other lives. And you feel a bit frustrated because of that. But by repeated effort, you wear down the tendency to repeat the mistake. And then there suddenly comes a time when you don't repeat it. And there is a jump like that. If it's an important aspect in one's life, there is a jump like that in the evolutionary progress. And it's only brought about by effort.
I think you feel a great satisfaction if you get over that.
Oh, yes.
You know, you lift it right away.
Yes. And there again, you see, once you do get over that and overcome the mistake, you immediately challenge the egoic force, the higher self, and it comes down like that. And the change in your individual life that the inflow of the egoic force can make is just amazing.
Yes.
When you're not doing anything worthwhile from the point of view of your own inner true nature, then there's no interest in the personality. This life goes on in the red band on its own and forgets about you. But if you do something that is of importance to your own inner future, destiny and perfection, then that life flows down. And making effort is the thing that does that. Making effort in an idealistic way, or refraining from action, so bad action such as losing your temper. Every time you refrain from losing your temper, you're exerting effort to overcome something that is habitual and belongs to your lower nature. In that case, to the body and elemental. But it's the same thing. That is what we're evolving against. The whole of our past and the permanent atoms and the creation of the bodies has a memory of the animal and the mineral, vegetable and animal existence. And the animal existence is based on competition and fear and all the primitive aspects of life. And so we're continuously fighting that. And the thing that fights it is our will, backed by intelligence and moved by love, to make effort to overcome.
I'd just like to ask you, if it's interesting, if you don't mind,
yeah.
Can you see, almost a vision, of the child you will have before birth?
Well,
conception?
A vision of the child before conception, before birth. I know people who have tried to do that and possibly succeeded. In my own case, I didn't, and I had no vision.
Well, I have yes. Myself. We just had the boys.
Yes.
And he saw, he would wake up in the morning and say, oh, I wish you could have seen my vision again. He saw it so many times. Yes. A beautiful little baby girl, only the head.
Yes.
Curly-headed little baby. And he would get up and say, I couldn't touch you to wake you because I would lose it.
Yes.
See? So he said, I've had my vision again. A pretty little baby girl, curly-headed.
Yes.
And he said, oh, I wish you could see it.
Yes.
And then time went by, he kept seeing this vision, and time went by, I began to carry a baby.
Yes.
And this baby, after I began to carry a baby, he never saw the vision again.
Yes.
But as time went on, and she was born, that baby was Maisie.
With the vision.
That's the vision.
My daughter.
Yes.
And if you saw her photographs and saw her as she was a baby, she was just like his vision.
Yes.
And that's her little teeny weeny curls over all over
yes.
the face. As you remember how she was with her curls and still is.
Yes.
But it was beautiful, and I've often thought, pondered over that, and thought, well, how nice to think that you saw the vision.
Yes.
And time went by, and I began with the baby, and she should come and be born. And yes. really, they were so close together. It seemed as though he'd known her, you know, right through.
Yes, well, probably there is that. That is the case. Those personal relationships of parents and children and husband and wife and near friends are the strongest ties, and they are the ties that are repeated life after life.
Yes.
Not always in the same relationship. And also, of course, you see, the pattern of the physical body did exist, must have existed right a long way back. And that would be there. That means there is something that you could tangibly, consciously pick up and get the image of the child before it was born, as happened in your case. Well, now perhaps we go a little bit further into karma while we're on the subject. Karma definitely belongs only to the personality level. It doesn't exist at the level of the higher self. Because there, no good and evil exist. There's only good. Evil only belongs below that level of the fourth, of the middle of the mental world. And reincarnation only exists up to that level. And evolution, as we know evolution, only exists there. There must be a comparative movement or growth from the egoic level upwards. But we wouldn't like to call it evolution as we know it. And the peculiar thing is that all these depend on space and time, especially time. Reincarnation disappears as soon as time disappears. So does evolution. And the purpose of reincarnation is to do away with the necessity to reincarnate. Now, that's an interesting idea, but that is true, and the same with evolution. The purpose for evolution is to make evolution unnecessary. The purpose of being individuals, separative selves, which we are in the world of the personality, is the whole purpose of that is that we lose those separative selves. So life exists in one form to annihilate that form to allow better to come into the picture. And you see, that is what causes so many of the paradoxes in philosophy and theosophy. Because of that cyclic annihilation of one principle and the replacement of another. And where we are, we don't understand the higher principles, we can only see the lower ones.
Rukmini made some remarks that she said, we are just problem makers, we create our problems.
Yes, we create all our problems, and this is how we create them. This is the key to the whole thing. The auric envelope is pure at birth. As I said, it contains only the past, and that in a latent form. Then we immediately meet something that through the senses gives us a stimulus. First of all, physical stimuli such as heat and cold, and a feeling of hunger and lack of warmth and all that sort of thing. But then they get more complex, and they form little complexes of very minor nature in the beginning in the mental and astral bodies. Yes, the etheric too, but mostly in the mental and the astral bodies. And then we get a lot more sense impressions, a lot more emotional responses, and we build those up and up and up. And after a while they get out of hand, just like cancer is the same thing at the physical level. The pattern gets lost and it becomes a wart or a canker. In other words, we react strongly every time we meet a similar situation. We get fixations of mind and heart towards things. And those fixations of mind and heart, which grow bigger and bigger as we get older and tend to dominate us more, are the things that hold us back. Because the normal way in which the life of the higher self comes down into the lower personality is through, first of all, the mental body and then the astral body. It comes down right through the whole lot, through each subplane. Well, when the astral body and the mental body are in violent movement, it can't come through purely. It gets twisted and distorted, do you see? So the life of the higher self can't get through. And what is stopping it is our preconceived attitudes of mind. Krishnamurti says, of course, that you should meet every situation with an absolutely open mind. You should meet every person as though you'd never seen them before. Because if you meet them and immediately think, now, what happened when I last met that person? I didn't like that person. Last time I met them, we had a row. You're perpetuating the row. But if you can meet them as though you'd never had a row with them at all, just meet them frankly and openly, you're not perpetuating it. And that means that karma is a repetition of habitual action caused by the binding power of the self-created binding power of the self. You see? And all we have to do is to stop binding ourselves. And the aim then is karma-less action, which I was talking about from Miss Montgomery yesterday. Karma-less action is action which doesn't bind. And if that action has the quality of impersonal love behind it, no matter what the action is, then it doesn't bind. Krishnamurti himself says, love and do what you will. And if the motive is pure love of an unselfish type, then the action must be right. It may seem wrong from the point of view of the world, but it's right from a spiritual point of view.
I just read that idea in Clara Conn's book, Sir Richard Light, this morning.
She got it there.
The same,
Yes.
Where she met a Jew in the London Theosophical Society, and she was very repelled by his personality, and she set herself to work to outlive it or live it down until she loved him.
Yes.
As a brother.
Yes.
Same idea. I haven't put it in the exact words, but the idea is
That is right, yes. In Clara Codd's book, evidently, there's a reference of how she set out to love a person that she didn't like, or whose personality she didn't like. And that, of course, is something that we can do as a moral training ourselves. And you can't do it if you're strong enough, you can do it and just cut off the dislike and replace it with love. But most of us have to do it gradually, bit by bit. But it's amazing, once you start, make the initial effort, how easy the thing becomes. Because you do get help from the higher principle. Now, I think we ought to talk a little bit about what that higher principle is and how it works.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Several people have said to me that if they develop the good qualities in their nature, that they automatically wipe out what is poor in their nature. Is it not correct that what we should achieve is an all-round development?
Yes. Yes, that method is sublimation, isn't it? Where you dwell on that which is of the higher and that is of the good.
Well, it's surprising that it appears to me that it's easy to develop what is already partially developing oneself.
Yes.
But it's harder to develop what is definitely forming one's own side. But by developing what is already partially developed, we say a sweet temper, if one is possessed of a sweet temper, well, it's easy to develop that. It's not much good concentrating too much on it. Isn't it better to concentrate on something that one hasn't?
Oh, yes, yes. What you concentrate is on the good aspect of that in which you're lacking.
Yes.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Not what is good in you,
no,
but... But it's a bit difficult for us to know exactly what is right and what is good and what is bad in our own personalities. It has been said that from the Master's point of view, we often imagine that things that are good in our personalities are of use, and he finds those are the things that aren't of use, and something else is. That is one of the difficulties, because we can't get a completely imperfect completely impersonal picture of ourselves. We think we have, but it's a bit coloured by our own impressions of ourselves. But that's perfectly true. It's no good dwelling on things in which we are competent or quite well developed at the moment. We have to take our obvious failings and try and put something in place of those that is good.
Well, it's the Bible says, resist not evil, and overcome evil with good.
Yes, yes. It's no good resisting it because you build it up. Now, we've been told time and time again that we should fight for the right. Well, that was the idea even that Mrs. Besant put forward. There are and may be certain occasions where it's necessary to fight. But generally speaking, fighting only perpetuates the conflict. The better thing to do is to stand back and be impersonal in the matter, keep silence if there's an argument, and you'll find that that very silence does something to soothe the whole business over. And I'm beginning to think that at this stage of the world evolution, we're getting past the necessity to fight and argue. We're getting into a position where we've got to stand back and let forces develop themselves. And that would be replacing good for evil. But that idea is only just beginning to be spread, you see.
But when we understand, shouldn't we realize that a person that is doing evil is hurting themselves more than anyone else? And so at least if we couldn't love them, we'd be sorry for them. When a person eats green apples, they get a stomach ache. We don't hate them because they've done something contrary to nature.
Yes. But being sorry for them is not going to help them.
It shows a little sympathy, and we curb our impatience with them.
Yes, that's right. We tolerate them.
Then perhaps as we advance, we develop our love for them.
Yes. Yes, but that's quite right. You, the first step is to inhibit, to stop the feeling of annoyance or anger. Well, now I'd like to give you a little impression or picture of what is actually happening as far as consciousness of the ego playing through the worlds of the personality. It's the lens of the higher mind which focuses the Buddhic light in the world of unity to a conscious center, and the lens adjusts its relative position or its shape to direct the light to meet any part of the bodily mechanism that makes a call. Now, the egoic life at the causal level, it focuses itself. It would be diffuse, you see, here, but when it starts to play down through the personality, it only goes to the brain, incidentally. It can't go below the brain. The egoic life never goes down into the three lower subplanes of matter, the liquid, the solid, liquid, and gas. The egoic life never reaches that. It only reaches the etheric level. And the lowest etheric level is in the brain, the fourth subplane of the physical. So it's between the fourth subplane of the physical, and which is the beginning of the etheric, and the middle of the mental world, that the personality exists. And it's through that, those portions of our nature that the egoic life plays. And it's evidently a focus. And it has the ability to focus on any particular part of our activity. And generally speaking, only one at a time. Or maybe in higher stages of evolution, we can focus on more. This focus point of light, the life concentrated to a center, is the ego, the interior organ, the individual and indivisible human consciousness itself. And the lens of the mind is that which focuses the light of the higher principles as it passes into the lower worlds. Now, this focusing of the light is accompanied by a searching drive for experience, and it is a swift succession of flashing impacts of life, of light, at inestimable speed, and focused as a brilliant center of intense creative activity. Now, if you have a thought in your mind at the moment, at the mental level, and it can apply, of course, to the upper mental level, which is the abstract ideas, but there you've got a fusion of the higher self and the lower self. But if you focus on a lower idea, like an arithmetical sum, then your consciousness, focusing on that as a bright point through the mental body, aids you to work that out, and it links up the whole of your experience in the mental world. Now, in the mental world, we have complete experience, possibly not only of what we've learnt during this life, but what we've learnt at night out of the body. And the only thing, as I said, that stops the link up is these self-created warts and complexes. But provided you can keep it clear and your thought clear, then that focus of light can link up with all the ideas, and a solution to every problem is possible.
Is that in the higher mental?
Or in either of the mental worlds, yes. But it has to come down from that level to the brain. And if your emotional body is upset, then it's distorted. And you all know that if you're excited or emotionally disturbed, you can't think clearly because it doesn't come down that way. Intuition, incidentally, comes from the Buddhic down through the emotional into the brain, probably doesn't even touch much of the emotional. It comes down through those atomic subplanes that I was talking of yesterday, and it's direct, and therefore is free of the bodies and is not coloured by your thoughts and feelings. Well, this consciousness is a focus of intense life, and it's playing through all the time. Now, I was going to get back to the hindrances there. I've forgotten my thought at the moment. We can dwell at any center, at any level, and get a response from the ego. But when you look at it from a development point of view, from the yoga point of view, you find that the light is moving so rapidly, various points, and linking them all up like that, your flashes of consciousness, that you can't slow it down sufficiently to get it focused on any one point. Now, for long enough, concentration and mental development and study will help you do that. But one of the other methods they use is breathing. Now, breathing has a link with the flow through the brain and the higher bodies, because it's the breath of God in the physical body. And if you slow your breathing down, or if you make it rhythmic, and this is Hatha Yoga, you see, but it's the spiritual aspect of Hatha Yoga, then you can slow down, or it helps to slow down, the brain, the focus of that light, until it will stay put. And that, of course, then gives you what is almost clairvoyance. It would certainly be an ability to concentrate mentally and would lead immediately to a Buddhic experience and the knowledge of the whole of the universe. And you can get that by concentrating completely on anything at all, which is what Madame Blavatsky said. But you must slow down, first of all, your attention, rivet that completely, slow down the bodily functions until the automatic life of the body is completely forgotten about, and you've got to still all your other thoughts and slow down the astral mental body completely, and breathing will help you, and then you suddenly get that complete awareness, which is the aim, you see, to get the unity. And that can take place when any contemplation on any subject.
I have found that when I've been worried about something, or couldn't make up my mind which of two actions to take, if I slept on it, the answer's there in the morning.
That's right.
I found that time again.
Yes. That's much the best way, because you see, nervous tension is one of the worst things, and that is the etheric level. And emotional tension is astral, and it's just as bad. You're forming by those two a barrier, and it can't get through. Now, you go to sleep and relax when you're asleep. It's important to relax the physical body and the emotional, mental bodies when you go to sleep, and the etheric especially. Then your higher self during sleep will contact the astral mental body, and the memory and solution will be there. You can do that in waking consciousness, provided you relax sufficiently and let the intuition work. Now, the intuition works, generally speaking, when you're intensely concentrated at the mental level. You suddenly find that the mental body, that the mental activity stops, and a whole inspiration comes through that illuminates the whole thing, and you've got an idea. And it's so elusive, it usually slips away. And the same thing happens at night, which is what you were saying, Miss Simmons was saying. You get an intuition or memory at night or astral experience, and the first thing you do if you wake at all is take a pencil and write it down, because in the morning it may have gone. But for the solution of a problem which already exists in the mind, I think it's more likely that the solution would exist in a fixed form. Now, dissociation of the focus from the things of the lower mind is important, and there is the technique of modifying the position and shape of that which the focus point of life shall play on and vivify, stopping the mental image and focusing on external ideas or feelings, astro-mental. This is what I was talking about. This is concentration, focusing constantly on one point. The egoic consciousness can now come through and without hindrance. Now, the lines of communication are called the antikarana. And for us, the antikarana, the bridge between the higher and the lower, is that fourth subplane of the mental world. That is the antikarana. It's the point from which we're building a connection into the higher world. When we get on a bit further and intuition becomes a faculty, then we will start building from the middle of the Buddhic world forward into the Atmic and developing will. But at the moment we've reached a certain degree of perfection in the concrete mind, and we are working towards perfection in the world of ideas and abstract thought, which is the higher mental world, and touching the intuitional world, creative world of the Buddhic. So that's the point from which we're working. There is, when we develop, there is a tendency, well, it's a method of development, just as reincarnation is another method. In the method by which consciousness develops is the starting off points, or the point at which the focus is mostly sort of tied down to. It's like the focus was it can move all over the place, but the focus has a sort of a tie, like a goat on the end of a rope. It's the post, you see, that the rope is tied to, and for us that is the middle of the mental world. Well, now, in the past it was the middle of the astral world, and there is a tendency once, or there is a method by which once we have developed certain aspects, they become a reflex, automatic, and are accepted by us without any degree of intelligence. Now, we're aided in that by the body mechanism, which is the elemental kingdom, which takes charge of the body and protects it, because its life only exists as long as the body exists. It then goes back into the reservoir of force. It's consciousness on its way down into incarnation, and it identifies itself with bodies wherever it can to get that experience. And that is what we have as our body elemental, that which looks after the breathing and the reflex action. And it warns us, it becomes instinct too, you see. Well, then there is a tendency, or method's a much better word, for a lot of our etheric activity, the flow of the nervous system, to become automatic. And there is a tendency for the life of the astral world to become automatic. And psychism of a lower nature belongs to that which we have already developed, and is and should be automatic. But once it becomes automatic, it sort of goes below the threshold of consciousness and becomes subconscious. And it's better to leave it in the subconscious and forget about it, and to think of the bridge from which we're trying to build. And that, of course, is the mental world for us at our stage of evolution. But for the fourth root race, they're still back in the astral to a large extent. And today we're getting most of our jazz music and stuff from the astral, the fourth root race, which isn't very good, really. It's one of the things that's an outcome of our materialistic attitude, I think. Well, the only other points, heaps and heaps we could go into, but before we stop, I'd like to mention the chakras that are the link between the higher and the lower. Now, I talked about the plexus here, solar plexus, which is the link for the spreading of those two primal forces and how they interact. And then it flows up the nervous system, so two, the sympathetic and the cerebrospinal. And as it goes, it takes in energy, which is vitality, prana, and vivifies all the other centers. And as we develop, so the greater force of Kundalini, the coiled up force, flows, and it vivifies in an amazing way the various centers. Well, the centers, the next center is the heart center, which is the emotional center, the astral center, and it is the one that is linked with the Christ consciousness of each one of us, and is fully developed, and it's become completely controlled by us, and because it's completely controlled, no harm, no wrong can ever occur by concentrating on that center. So if we can feel thoughts of love, in our heart, the golden glow of the heart, which is linked with the second ray, the second aspect of the Trinity, which is Christ consciousness, then we can only do good. And any healing that you try and do yourself, or any helping of people, do it from the heart and you're all right. You can never do harm. And it's linked up, strange say, with the whole of the universe through that center. And it's linked with the Buddha because of that. But this one is the lower mental. And then this one up here, well, the two, the pineal and pituitary, various people, the throat is the lower mental, generally speaking, and these are the two higher ones. Some people work on the pineal and some on the pituitary, but most on the pituitary, which is the crown chakra, which is this one. And it is there that your consciousness comes in from the higher worlds, comes down as a funnel of light. When it's coming down, that's where the egoic consciousness enters. And in the brain, you see, it meets the flow coming up through the spinal, the etheric system, and comes down and the two meet. And that is the consciousness. So when you see something with a sense, because we our bodies work on the senses, it's transferred through the etheric, by touch through the etheric to the brain. The brain sends a stimulus up through the higher etheric, through the astral to the mental, and we correlate past experience and interpret what the touch was, and the answer comes back, and that's going on all the time. If we pick up thoughts at a higher level, then they come down through the mental astral into the etheric brain, and we can interpret them as speech, and we can take necessary action by means of the senses. You see, that's going on all the time, and that's how the build-up occurs. And the thing that correlates it is consciousness, which is the play of the higher. Now, I said yesterday that if God withdrew, the Creator withdrew the will of his Fohat, his manifesting force, the whole of the universe would disintegrate. It's exactly the same with us as little gods. If we withdraw the force of the monad through the personality, through the ego, and therefore the personality, then it disintegrates. First of all, the physical body, and then when the withdrawal takes place, the etheric goes at death, and then another withdrawal, and the astral goes, and the essence of experience is carried back. I've got it here in the blue. As the withdrawal takes place, the essential experience is withdrawn back into the life. So if you remember those principles, there's only good can remain here. It's only good that is taken back. The evil remains at the lower level, and karmically we pick it up next life. We can't get away from it as long as it exists. We pick it up next life. But the good goes back and is built into this. If you can remember those principles, that first one, that consciousness on the lower levels is veiled, is limited, is hindered, is soft-pedaled, it is cushioned, so that it slows down the rate of vibration and the clarity of consciousness as the lower levels are reached. Successively, as you go down, consciousness is veiled. That's the key to the whole thing. And then the force of the ego coming down becomes less. It's higher here in the upper mental world, and it gets less as you go down to the physical. So the impact of the higher self on the physical world, or at the brain consciousness level, is less than it is in the mental world. As when you're asleep at night, therefore the impact is stronger, and you can get your questions answered easier. That's an important principle, and the second one, the other principle is to realize that it's the flow, the ebb and flow, the in-breathing and out-breathing of the higher self, the egoic life, through the personality that makes life possible within that body. And the last one, of course, is that it's we ourselves having a sense of separativeness, which is developed and which belongs to that personality, that cuts us off from everybody else and allows us to build up little complexes. And those complexes are the hindrances that stop us understanding our own spiritual nature and the nature of the unity of manifestation. those principles, if you apply them, give you a big knowledge of what we are and the position which we are. Now, and these three talks really, I've tried, covered most of what is basic theosophy. It's the principles, you see, not the details, but the principles. And if you get those principles first, they'll help you in an interpretation of all the details.